My business partner had walked into his buzzer store in Philippi Village, just outside the solution space. And he met a trader there who was crying. And it was a man who was old enough to be my father. And he asked him in Xhosa, Baba Ukhalelan, which translates to, why are you crying? And he said, all I ever want to do is to feed myself, feed my family, and feed my business. And we asked him, okay, cool. Dando asked him, okay, cool, what's the real issue? And as he had a conversation with him, he realized he was short of 10,000 bucks. And really, the truth of the matter was like, okay, 10,000 wasn't a lot of money. Obviously, for him, it was everything at that particular point in time. And the more we engaged with him, we realized, actually, capital isn't the real issue here. The issue here is that he's not able to meet his working capital cycle.
One income can transform a household. In communities where every cent counts, financial inclusion isn't just about being welcomed into a formal banking system. It's about being empowered to build a better future. A small amount of money can make a big difference to entrepreneurs. So why is it getting so difficult?
Of 7 billion people in the world, close to 2 billion are either underbanked or unbanked in some way. And what I mean by underbanked or unbanked, unbanked is obvious. They don't have a relationship with a banking institution of any type, Now, underbanked is even if they do, they're not getting to participate in the financial mainstream and do things that you and I take for granted, which means being able to access credit when you need it at a reasonable price, being able to access insurance of the type that's relevant to you, being able to do things of that nature, save for a rainy day in the right way, all that done in a form that's good for you as the consumer.
Access to finance in any region is essential if we as a global community are to achieve the 17 United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, especially those relating to poverty, hunger, health, and gender equity. Having the ability to save after meeting basic needs or access to credit are two factors which are critical to enable investment in businesses, react in emergencies, afford healthcare, quality education, and participate fully in society. Necessity is the mother of invention, and this is especially true in the informal economic sector, where innovations emerge that meet users where they are, literally. The story of M-Pesa is a good example.
M-Pesa is the world's leading mobile money service. It gives people without traditional bank accounts access to financial services. Using their phone numbers as account numbers and their mobile phones as mobile wallets, users are able to make transfers, pay for goods and services, access credits and savings, and much more. The onboarding process is authenticated through a national identity card, and each transaction is validated via SMS. M-Pesa users can fund their accounts either through an authorized agent or a bank to M-Pesa top-up. Cash withdrawals can also be made through an authorized agent or an ATM.
Welcome to Season 4 of the Just for a Change podcast, powered by the Bertha Center for Social Innovation and Entrepreneurship. I'm your host, Ntombini Marangani. In this new season, we're looking at unexpected connections, surprising overlaps, and unusual alignments in the work being done locally and globally that's moving our societies forward in positive ways. Innovations like M-Pesa in Kenya work for so many people because traditional banking systems don't. Banks rely on formal documentation like tax filings and income statements, often require assets for collateral, and want to see a complete credit history. Most commercial banks don't offer bridging finance or capital investment to small and medium-sized enterprises, as it is considered too risky, or if they do, the interest is prohibitively high. This is where sustainable capital steps in, which is especially suited to an African financial market. Later on, I will ask our guest, Prince Nwadei, to explain more. But before we get to that, let's hear from Phumza Matwele.
My name is Phumza Matwele. I am the director of Unimic Trading, Pty Ltd, known as Sharp Left Medstore. My entrepreneurial journey started about 10 years ago, right from the Raymond E. Kamin Academy. My business is aimed to set up over-the-counter medication pharmacy in local communities around where there are no access to basic medications. We have so far delivered the vision to some communities around Cape Town. Yet, a lot still needs to be done in reaching other communities in need of our service.
Pumza is the founder of Unimike Trading, an over-the-counter pharmacy and healthcare center in Khayelitsha, Western Cape. After completing business training at the Raymond Ackerman Academy of Entrepreneurial Development, Pumza was able to get finance from the SAB Foundation's Tolwana Enterprise Program Alumni Fund. The fund allows recipients to access support in the form of grants and interest-free loans, provided that they meet certain criteria. The aim of this growth fund is to increase participants' turnover and create as many new jobs as possible. Pumza shares with us the difference that working capital made in her business and life.
Having the opportunity to be selected among 60 entrepreneurs from over 1,000 applications to be supported by the SAB Foundation, it was an open door for me and my business with the fund that I procured from the SAB Foundation. I was able to buy a vehicle for the day-to-day operations of the business and set up a new shop, which also gave more opportunity to others from our local communities to have a job in our establishment.
As Pumza's experience highlights, access to even small amounts of capital can make an enormous impact on a household and a community. What does this mean at the household level? Those small investments can change the trajectory of families. As jobs are created, social, health, and education outcomes are improved, with positive effects rippling outwards indefinitely. So we see that business success doesn't necessarily look like a unicorn startup worth a billion. But what has more social impact is thousands of small businesses, each uplifting the families and neighborhoods around them. Just a reminder to subscribe to this podcast so that you don't miss other episodes. And be sure to spread the word about the Just for Change series. South Africa, one of Africa's biggest economies, has an estimated 3 million micro and informal businesses, accommodating many marginalized communities. According to a 2023 study, more than 60% of those who start an informal business do so because they are unemployed and have no alternative source of income. Joining me today is Prince Nwadei, an inclusive innovation specialist in financial services. A Bertha scholar, he is the founder of Ispani, a data insight and consulting business focused on informal emerging markets, and Sitana Capital, which provides finance to informal traders. He is also an advisor for Bitprop, a property technology player in South Africa that provides access to infrastructure finance for previously financially excluded individuals in low-income communities. Thank you so much for joining me today, Prince. I'm so keen to hear how you are helping to drive financial inclusion in Africa.
Thank you so much for having me. It's absolutely a pleasure to be here with you, Ntombini, and super excited for our chat. Yeah, really, really keen to engage and discuss.
Could you please explain to our listeners what sustainable capital is and how it works?
So sustainable capital, in my view, is specifically capital that is deployed to a business or into an ecosystem with the agenda not just to be extractive in its nature, but to create the right sort of network effects for the ecosystems which it serves. So by way of example could be, if we go out and deploy capital to finance, let's say, an informal trader, we don't just look at the return that we get from the informal trader in capital. We also focus on, does this actually lead to growth in their underlying business? Do we make sure that that also creates jobs as a consequence? And is the community better off because of the intervention that we had in being able to deploy capital to that particular entrepreneur or business person? That, in our view, is what sustainable capital is. It's capital that doesn't just focus on the return alone, but also looks at the sort of network effects that it has within society. And its persistence is not necessarily required or dependent on further capital being pushed in, that its intervention actually creates an ongoing circular effect for sustainability within those environments.
Wow, that's a big ask from an investment. And I'm really curious as to how you actually link up with these informal traders who can then benefit from access to sustainable capital. But we'll come to that in just a moment. What can you tell me about the working capital finance gap currently faced by small and medium and micro enterprises in Africa at the moment?
Sure. So the working capital finance gap that sits on the continent is quite significant. Last I checked, it was sitting at around $331 billion. Mm. This is a massive amount of capital that is literally can't be met by one individual or financial services business. So it means that there's a huge opportunity to make a difference while building sustainable operations. But far more importantly, I think one of the biggest opportunities, the challenges that also emerge, is the fact that the ability to deploy capital to these entrepreneurs is more often than not hamstrung by the fact that existing financial services players don't know how to do it. And what I mean by that, they don't have the understanding, the insight, and they need to be innovative in terms of how they think about the deployment of their capital. For us as a business, our approach has been relatively different and has taken an intermediated approach through partnership with wholesalers and channel providers to enable us to reach those entrepreneurs. And typically for us, we don't necessarily give guys money directly. We would fund their stock, or would fund their fuel in the case of ride hailing operators. We would fund what we call the value making process of that particular vertical operation.
And I think that's really important, because if one thinks about access to capital, often we think about a small business person, whether in the formal or informal sector, accessing finance, perhaps from a bank or a loan from family networks, and just getting that cash. And hopefully the person does invest it in an income producing way into their business. But what you've explained is that you take that burden off the borrower and invest it for them directly. Do you work with them to do research on how to access perhaps more economical or more valuable supply chains? Or do you simply just say, okay, you've been using this service provider, I'll go and pay them on your behalf?
At this particular point in time, we don't necessarily take the approach that you've described. And maybe it will add value to me to give you a bit of color in terms of how, maybe where it came from, which might be interesting to also paint a picture around it.
Okay.
The story behind why we decided to, for example, start the working capital finance business came as a result of, as you said, we ran a business called East Bunny, which still operates. We had just come back from client assignment in Kenya. And we'd finished a research project for one of our Swedish clients. And when we returned, my business partner had walked into a spaza store in Philippi Village, just outside the solution space. And he met a trader there who was crying. And it was a man who was old enough to be my father. And he asked him in Tosa, Baba Okalelan, which translates to, why are you crying? And he said, all I ever want to do is to feed myself, feed my family, and feed my business. And we asked him, okay, cool. Dando asked him, okay, cool, what's the real issue? And as he had a conversation with him, he realized he was short of 10,000 bucks. And really, the truth of the matter was, like, okay, 10,000 wasn't a lot of money. Obviously, for him, it was everything at that particular point in time. And the more we engaged with him, we realized, actually, capital isn't the real issue here. The issue here is that he's not able to meet his working capital cycle, because from this business, he's paying the kids' school fees, he's not paying himself a salary, he's sorting out black tax issues. There are multiple things that are pulling on the business, so he doesn't have enough stock in the shop. So we came up with this idea that instead of providing capital to an individual entrepreneur directly, we could partner with wholesalers, get access to their trading data of this specific individual spaza store, analyze that data, and come up with an amount that we could allocate to them. And then we could recoup that capital back from the wholesaler once the trader pays back. And we could be a revolving type facility for them to consistently draw down on, which is effectively the approach that we took, which resulted in the idea that we then created, which was Satana Capital. And we specifically focus on what we call taking an embedded first approach. So we don't go directly to the spaza store. We always now partner with existing operators or channel providers within that space. We focus on what we call our demand inelastic sectors. So those are sectors where the impact of whatever happens within the broader macro economy doesn't necessarily affect the demand for that particular product or item, specifically dependent on the sort of business model that's being deployed by that vertical. So, for example, with spaza stores, we're primarily buying stock for them. The ride-hailing space, we're focusing on looking to finance fuel for Uber drivers and operators in that environment. So we look at demand in elastic spaces. Thirdly, we need to make sure we're financing what we call the value-making process. So we're finding stock or fuel. Number four is we deploy capital in a space where we believe we're able to build what we call a defensible moat. So that's to say we're able to defend our position and really create outsized value beyond the capital that we have. So the way in which we add value has to be beyond just our available capital, but our business model, our process, the way in which our product works. It needs to be defensible in effect. And what is most importantly is five and six, is that we need to be able to see that our capital creates the right sort of flywheel effect for growth, which basically means we need to see when we deploy capital and going to the initial definition that I discussed with you around sustainable capital, we need to see that that capital actually results in growth in that entrepreneur. We've had guys that we started out giving 40,000 and in 5 months they were taking 200,000 and returning that capital in 14 days. And after that, they were like, Prince, you know what? We don't need your money anymore because we can stand on our own 2 feet. And those are the sorts of stories that we want to see. And then the other piece is that we need to see it build stickiness between ourselves, the entrepreneur, and the channel partner. So those criteria need to hold true before we look to deploy capital within a particular environment or sector. And that's largely been the way we've found that we are best capable to add value to the entrepreneurs in that space. We're starting to build intelligence as well. Funny story was, there was a time when we lent out money to a particular operator and we hadn't yet started taking cognizance of the kinds of products they were buying. And then we realized that we just gave this guy like 40,000 rand and he had bought a ton of Coca-Cola crates, but in the heart of winter. Obviously, he was not going to be able to move his stock within the 14-day period that was required. And then he came back and was like, guys, I can't pay you back on time. Give me an extra week or two and stuff. And we gave him the grace period. But what was funny about it was that we started realizing that it's necessary for us to also start advising the entrepreneurs to think differently about how they stock up their shops and to be sensitive to certain changes and seasons. Like you can't stock up your shop with a bunch of Romani creams and like Coca-Cola in the heart of winter and expect to move your stock. So starting to add that intelligence, not only to our credit scoring model, but also to advise them to say, hey, based on what we're seeing on other stores in the area purchasing that are successful stores, we think you need to think differently about your basket mix. So that's another way in which we're starting to look to add value to the operators in this space.
That must be filling a huge gap because up until now, without the landscape picture of what's happening in these shops, shop owners and individual operators are just kind of going through by feel, right? What they think is moving, what they see is going, not necessarily applying a formula to it. That's pretty amazing. I want to come back to that as well a bit later. But first, while you were in university, you founded Hispani, which you've mentioned, a business that focuses on enabling access to critical data insights on rural and peri-urban townships in South Africa. Why did you think this was needed?
Oh, wow. That is a very interesting question. So the story goes like this. I was sitting in a marketing lecture that was being given by Prof. Simpson from the Unilever Institute at UCT at the time. And if I'm 100% honest, guys, I was a bad student. I was so disinterested in the lecture. Up until Prof. Simpson suddenly said, the informal sector in South Africa is valued at 600 billion rand, about twice the size of agriculture's contribution to GDP. And we're struggling to gain insight on the space. And a lot of brands and businesses are talking to us to figure out how to like unlock data insight in this on this particular market. And this is the time when they were having these reports on black diamonds, the growing economy in this sort of environment. And I literally sat up. That's when I like started focusing on the lecture. And we started the business because on the one side, we realized there was a huge problem to solve to unearth data insight on informal market communities. But then the second component that also became a huge burden for us was we also realized that there was also a huge gap for youth unemployment. And there are a lot of young people in the townships who operated in this environment, but could equally add value to how products and services end up manifesting within their communities. So we realized that we could build what we call micro data entrepreneurs, who could effectively become data collection agents, who could collect data in real time on behalf of any brand or business through our software platform, and pass on that data to us in a two-sided marketplace where we set the price. And we could take that data in effect and offer it to universities, offer that data to large corporates who are looking to build new products, innovate and service these communities, and utilize that insight to then consult. And that really became the catalyst behind why we decided to start this business. I remember the first project we got was from one of our lecturers at UCT. It was like a 5,000 Rand project to do some data collection in Khayelitsha, where we had to, I mean, as students, 5,000 Rand was a lot of money for us. So we were like, we're going to be rich. but on a serious note, the more we got on the ground and we did the data collection in Khayelitsha, we began to realize, wow, there's actually a bigger problem we can solve here beyond just thinking with our commercial minds. There's an impact story here of how we could change the way in which corporate doesn't understand these markets, and we could actually help them to build products and services that and market in a responsible way within these ecosystems. And from there, we worked with the likes of Duracell, Bioco, AB InBev, Munich, Swiss Re, Liberty, Naspers. We did a ton of work within the informal space. The United Nations Development Program, I think we did the biggest climate change study they did in South Africa, 10,000 youth we had engaged with utilizing our micro data entrepreneurs. So there was a ton of work that we started doing, and we saw how much that insight played such a big role in shifting thinking and affecting policy and affecting strategy, but ultimately adding value to those communities. But I think in many ways, the journey that segued into Satana also was as a result of the fact that we realized that our data insight could only do so much. We still saw huge spaces of opportunities for products that could be created, but corporates didn't necessarily have the incentive to do so at that particular point in time, specifically in the lending space. And that's when we realized that we see the value, we understand the ecosystem. We know that if we can create this product for lending, we can solve a huge problem. But if we're going to wait for a big financial services firm to go through all the processes internally to do it, it's not going to happen. And that's when we decided to take the plunge.
The mission of your company, Satana Capital, is to provide $1 billion in working capital to 100,000 SMMEs on the continent by 2032. How close are you to this goal?
Wow, we're not as close as we intend to be, but we're on that journey. Our target is hopefully by the end of this year, we would have done about steady state. If I don't push the team, we'll get to 100 million. Rand, but our target is 200 million Rand in capital deployed by the end of this year to SMEs and informal traders within the informal sector. We've been blessed to have Alan Gray as our key financial services backer from a capital provision perspective through the Empowerment Arm E-Squared. So they've been super supportive of the work that we're doing.
Fantastic. Satana lends to informal traders and boasts a 99.5% repayment rate. What do you think most lenders or investors don't know or should know about informal traders and how they do business?
One of the things that I think operators or financial services players or lenders should know about the informal sector is the fact that they probably work harder than most of us. They have a vested interest to make sure that they maintain their line of capital that we provide to them, primarily because they know they won't get one elsewhere. And the next best alternative is someone who's going to charge them a significantly exorbitant rate of interest. So the likelihood of you to get your capital back is high. However, you need to systematize the approach. You don't go in there and just, we call it spray and pray. You don't just throw away money and pray that you get it back.
Okay.
You still have to be picky. You've got to pick the right operators correctly, but you've got to think boldly and differently around what are the tools and criteria that I'm going to use to assess the risk that I'm going to deploy in the space. And in many ways, you've got to think about it from the perspective of, so in our environment, if I talk about lending, what we look at is we look at, is there consistency of purchase of this particular product or service that this person is wanting us to provide finance for? What are the turnaround cycles? What's my collection mechanism? And how do I innovate around this process to de-risk my capital? What we've done is we've just said, we're not going to give you cash. We're going to give you the stock. We're going to pay the wholesaler. You're going to get the stock. You're going to pay us back. But we then built a data tool that enables us to consume a ton of data and then make quick decisions based off what we've determined to be a successful entrepreneur within particular criteria. So then you test that over a period of time. And the more it continues to check out, you then are able to increase and scale your business model and then start building your defensibilities and other sorts of pieces in there. I think at its core, they need to recognize that the entrepreneurs there are real. We've seen people who are building very sustainable operations. I can tell you stories of guys and Alex who are making 100,000 rand every 2 weeks selling bread. They're making more money than most professionals. I can tell you stories of people who are selling like your traditional FMCG goods businesses, and they're doing 400,000 rand, if not more, a month in revenue. So people who are actually running real businesses, but banks would never touch, traditional financial services institutions would never touch. And they're creating jobs. They're employing 10 people, 15 people. They're creating real jobs, which are sustaining families and helping parents to take their kids to school. Not probably Model C school, Model C schools or private schools, but they're giving them the education that they can afford. But the reality of the matter, those businesses are contributing to the peace and stability we have in our country at a systemic level. And it would be wrong for us not to find ways to make those businesses more resilient and make those businesses to scale and to grow where we can with responsible capital. So I think it would be to say to corporate South Africa, there's a real opportunity. If you don't understand it, partner with companies like ourselves, which is what started happening, where we're starting to see organizations approach us to say, hey, listen, we have these funds. We don't know how to deploy them into the space, but you seem to have a track record of doing this and doing this well. Can we work with you to give us this exposure? And we think there are multiple opportunities and verticals that sit within this ecosystem.
Two questions that we ask our guests at the end of each episode this season. I'm going to ask them to you now. What does social justice mean to you?
Social justice means to me that we're able to live in and create a society where people have equality of representation, equality of opportunity as much as is possible, and the ability to the best of the opportunity available to them to be able to achieve their dreams and goals. You might not be able to achieve them, but at least get the chance at the very least. And then also, I think that everyone is equal before the law. I think that's such an important piece. And I think if we can reduce the barriers to what it means to be able to live in dignity for the vast majority of our people and for the reality of South African democracy to not be a dream that's been perpetually deferred for the vast majority of our people, I think that for me would be social justice.
And why do you do what you do, Prince?
I do what I do because I think I was born for it. I honestly speaking, I don't think that I could have done anything else. Entrepreneurship for us and for me is not really about making money. That's great. It's an offshoot of it. But the core of why we do what we do is because we truly believe that we've been called to build businesses and organizations that will change and transform the trajectory of the African continent to the betterment of its people. For us, business is an end to make an, is a tool or a channel through which we can make an impact on the world and our communities, but one that's scaled and one that fundamentally transforms the trajectory of society. That's why we do what we do. We want to see the world, want to see our continent in a better place. Like I said, I'm living for 2063. Not that I'm going to die then, but I'm living because for 2063, because that's the stake in the ground for me, because I don't want to have the same conversations I've had to have with my parents and other elders about why our country and our continent is the way it is. I think we should at least have a different conversation with our children when the time comes.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Prince, for sharing your insights with us. It's exciting to see how innovative finance is helping us to move forward towards a more just and equitable future on our continent, as you say, and beyond. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Sincerely appreciate it.
In this episode, we've explored the value of financial inclusion and seen how it can unleash untold potential for even the smallest business owner. Accessible capital and credit can be the seeds that flourish into healthier families, stronger communities, and a more just world. Thank you for tuning in to Season 4 of the Just for a Change podcast, powered by the Bertha Center for Social Innovation and Entrepreneurship. If you're interested in hearing more about Unexpected Connections, then make sure you subscribe to this podcast so that you don't miss any of our upcoming episodes. If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate and review it wherever you listen to your podcast, and feel free to share it with your friends, family, and colleagues. Let's stay inspired and keep changing the way we're changing the world. This podcast is produced by Two Stories in collaboration with the Bertha Center for Social Innovation and Entrepreneurship at the Graduate School of Business at the University of Cape Town. Written by Linda Scarborough, produced by Carol Williams, with audio editing, engineering, and sound design by Kozim Zimela and Duduzile Masuku, with production assistance from Without a Doubt Agency. Special thanks to the Bertha Center team and the Bertha Foundation for their input on this series. For more information on resources used to create this episode, please refer to the show notes.